Hello, and welcome to Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Ellen Ward. I'll continue now with the essay, My Malformed Bones, Harry Crew's Contra Lives by Charlie Lee, which was published in the July 2025 issue. Discussed in the essay are two works written by Harry Crews. First, A Childhood, the Biography of a Place, and second, The Knockout Artist. His was an exceedingly brutal upbringing. Once he saw a man walk into a grocery store, take a knife from the butcher block, and plunge it into his own chest. "It feels good," the man said, as Crews watched him bleed to death. And never mind his mother getting shot at by his father. The most remarkable incident of his childhood occurred a few weeks before. It was deep winter, hog killing season, and neighboring families had gathered for a day of slaughter. Crews describes a raucous scene of work and merriment, the scent of blood in the cold air. Playing with the other kids, he tripped and fell into a vat of scalding water that was being used to slough hair from the hogs. Someone pulled him out, and Crews watched as the skin on his hand slid off like a wet glove. The burns all over his body were nearly fatal. He passed the days of his bedbound recovery looking at the models in the Sears Roebuck catalog. There was something dishonest, he believed, about their apparent perfection. It was all a lie. I knew that under those fancy clothes there had to be scars. There had to be swellings and boils of one kind or another, because there was no other way to live in the world. These memories are so pristinely preserved, so novelistic in their rendering, that at times it seems Crews must have invented them. But whether they were real or not is beside the point. Indeed, facts could be as strange as fiction. Not long after the shooting, Crews learned that the man he knew as his father may have been his uncle, and that his biological father had died before he turned two. What's impressive about a childhood is not how it faithfully documents the past. It's how, through stories, it grants some coherence to an otherwise rootless existence. Writing, Crews seemed to believe, was a thread through the maze, a means of imagining a place and a people to whom he could lay claim. At 17, he joined the Marines, following the path of his older brother, who had served in Korea. After 3 years on a Navy base outside Miami, Crews enrolled at the University of Florida, where he studied English on the GI Bill, and later joined the creative writing faculty. He rarely returned to Georgia, except in his fiction. He married and had a son with a woman named Sally Ellis. They divorced soon thereafter, then remarried and had another son. In 1964, their firstborn drowned in a neighbor's swimming pool. Crews' first novel, The Gospel Singer, is set in the fictional town of Enigma, Georgia. Its unnamed protagonist is a tormented singer whose talent has carried him into a life of itinerant celebrity and unbridled vice. He tours tent revivals, seducing crowds, saving souls, but despite his success, he still feels the smothering demands of home and kin. He had sprung from them, and that was their pride. Out of their blanched flesh and hookworm children and leached soil and poor bone cattle. He returns every 6 months in a spasm of guilt, dishing out favors and making amends, always plotting his next escape. The Gospel Singer was an assertion of Crews' southernness, of his claim both to the lofty inheritance of Faulkner and O'Connor and to the clipped and choral rhythms of Bacon County. It was also a fantasy of being welcomed back to one's hometown, an experience that Crews did not know firsthand. "They act like I'm a goddamn leper," he groused in 1977 after a visit spent conducting research for A Childhood. Crews had hoped the book would please his mentor, the novelist Andrew Lytle, an early champion of O'Connor's work who, in 1930, had contributed an essay to I'll Take My Stand, a reactionary manifesto defending white Southern culture. All the most obvious and noisome elements of Southern Gothic are present in The Gospel Singer, from the Christ-haunted fill-in to the traveling freak show to the novel's basic premise, a variation on the primal myth and originating anxiety of American white supremacy. The gospel singer returns to Enigma just as a local black man has been accused of raping and murdering a white woman. In a florid twist, he's innocent of the former, but guilty of the latter. But Lytle didn't care for the gospel singer. It ended in a lot of noise and violence, he sniffed. An end ought to bring everything together, purge the reader. The ending should fall off the tree like a ripe pear. Elvis, on the other hand, apparently loved it and wanted to star in a Hollywood adaptation. Between 1969 and 1971, Cruise published three more novels, all in a similar vein. Each has flares of humor and surprise, but there is something cramped about them too, a sense of exhausted expectations of a genre being pared down to a bundle of tropes. "You don't intend to make a career out of midgets, do you?" his wife asked him. He didn't. In 1972, the same year that Sally divorced him for the second and final time, Cruise came up with something new. Car, a satire of consumerism, or more precisely, of consumption. The novel is the story of a man named Herman who is so obsessed with cars that he decides to eat one, a Ford Maverick. He figures that going piece by piece, at a half pound a day, it'll take 10 years. Herman's father runs a car wrecking company, and in a sense, this scheme is Herman's quite literal-minded attempt to find his place in the family business. "I wanted to be somebody," he tries to explain. "A man has to take the chances that come to him." It's an existential quest, but it's also a publicity stunt. Herman eats the car on a stage outside a local hotel, whose owner charges admission and signs a deal for television rights. Herman's twin, Mr., arranges to get the family 25% of the profits. Crowds, this is Cruise's great novel of crowds, of their mindless delights and savage whims, come to bear witness to Herman's undertaking. Many of them see it as heroic, an act of great courage, but they don't just want to watch him eat the car, they want to see everything, down to the last painful passage of each bloody lump. Someone had cut a flap, a trapdoor, in the bottom of Herman's white shorts, and then sewn on black buttons to hold the flap shut. The crowd knew what that meant, and the screams of delight and anxiety were so great that Mr. could no longer make himself heard. Car is a hasty romp, barely 150 pages, but stylistically it seems looser, shaggier than the novels that came before. At times the language is rambling and exuberantly experimental. At others, Cruise plays with scouring away all sense until what remains is as jagged and bare as a heap of scrap metal. After Herman has given himself over entirely to his task, his thoughts are winnowed to a litany of the Maverick specifications, passing through his dulled and dim mind like leaves in slow wind. Three-speed synchronized manual transmission, locking steering column, flashing side marker lamps, four, located on front and rear fender sides. As car unfolds and the physical reality of Herman's unreal project becomes more concrete, how the car will be broken into bite-sized pieces, how the little clumps of metal that pass through Herman's body will be pressed into car-shaped keychain souvenirs, the novel swerves from a straightforward satire into a fretful parable of obsession, then into something even more searching and strange. Herman wants money and fame, that much is clear, and he wants to outdo his father, or perhaps gain his approval as a car wrecker of a different sort. He's also grieving. He has never forgiven himself for the death of a little girl who died in his family's junkyard when he was a child. But none of this adequately explains why a person would ingest an automobile. "Why would I want to eat a car?" Herman asks. "I'm going to eat a car because it's there." Eventually, his mission comes to seem to be about not so much the desire to consume the car as the desire to get over it or to get entirely outside it. Though getting outside something in this case involves getting that thing inside you. The only one who seems to understand even obliquely is a melancholy prostitute Herman befriends named Margot. On the novel's final page, after Herman fails to finish off the Maverick, after chowing through the front bumper, the grill, the fenders, and part of the hood, he gives up, saying, "I can't stand that kind of pain from something I love." Margot explains to him why she took up sex work. "I thought I could get rid of fucking by fucking," she says, "but I found out that won't work." Herman agrees. "You cannot fuck everybody," he replies. The tone is maddeningly ambiguous, somewhere between stupid and serious, hammy and apocalyptic. In other words, consummate cruise. In his lesser novels, the tragedies are maudlin and the jokes are mere punchlines. But here he's after more than just entertainment. Car is about desire, the desire to consume, but also the desire to change one's life, to transcend the pettiness and violence of the past. The novel can't convey Herman's reasons for wanting to eat the car, only that doing so is what gives his life meaning and shape and what nearly kills him. Herman becomes a new type of hero for Cruz, brave enough to pursue desire into the void, wise enough to quit while he still can. For Cruz, the 70s were a time of astonishing, feverish productivity. Car was followed by The Hawk is Dying, 1973, The Gypsy's Curse, 1974, and A Feast of Snakes, 1976, about another grisly spectacle, an annual rattlesnake-catching competition in the backwoods of Georgia. In 1978, he published A Childhood to the best reviews of his career. All the while, he was churning out long, exquisitely deranged pieces of new journalism. These were often portraits of people at work, jockeys, preachers, movie stars, that showcased the indiscriminate pleasure Cruz took in shop talk. "You work hanky-panks or alibis or flats?" he asked the carnival hustler in one piece. By the decade's end, he had published 8 novels in 8 years. It would be 11 years before he published another. He had long flirted with oblivion. "I am one of the all-time sloppy, disgusting drunks," he wrote in a 1975 essay for Playboy. "The kind mothers can point out to their children as an example of the final evil of alcohol." And now it overtook him. He'd come to see his writing life as a punishing exercise in perpetual failure. His typewriter finally tapped out after years of colliding with the wall. He stares out in photographs from this period with a drawn and thievish look. Journalists would come to interview him only to leave horrified by what they found. "Violence," one wrote, "follows Harry Cruz around like an oversized lapdog, eager to spring upon him with bone-crunching love." Another speculated in print that Cruz would soon be dead. In gasps of sobriety during what amounted to a decade-long binge, he sweated out one novel, All We Need of Hell, a limp, nervous effort pulled together mostly from earlier fragments. In 1986, some friends set Cruz up in a barn in northeastern Louisiana to dry out. He lived there alone with his dog for 10 months, mostly sober, working on something new. The novel he got down, The Knockout Artist, may be his best, and is certainly the last piece of sustained and worthy writing he ever did. It's a boxing novel, sort of. The protagonist, Eugene Biggs, is a former fighter wasting away in New Orleans. Unlike Cruz's earlier protagonist, he exists not in the frenzy of obsession, but in its aftermath, life's dull and shapeless coda. Eugene is quite a bit like Cruz. He grew up on a small farm in Bacon County, left at 17 for Jacksonville, and now, like the hero at the outset of any good boxing story, he's washed up. Boxing had initially appealed to Eugene as a way out of being a nobody, but after 13 wins, he started losing. The same story each time. One shot to the chin, lights out. His trainer, Bud, fled after realizing that Eugene's youthful promise wouldn't translate into mature success. Finally, after his fourth straight loss, staring at his reflection in the dressing room mirror, Eugene punched himself in the face and knocked himself out. When he came to, he realized with horror that he'd found his true talent. 2 years and 72 self-knockouts later, the novel begins. Eugene has joined the ranks of the many enterprising freak shows working in the New Orleans party circuit, where rich people pay him to dress up like a boxer and beat himself senseless. The money's decent, but he sends almost all of it back home. He lives in an apartment paid for by his girlfriend, Charity, a beautiful oil heiress and graduate student in psychology. Of all the femme fatale who populate Cruise fiction, Charity is surely the weirdest and the most comically sinister, something like a cross between an evil scientist and a catalog model, with teeth so perfect they should have been false, and eyes like little delicate calipers. She calls Eugene's apartment her living laboratory and mines his life for material, believing it could prove to be the key to her academic breakthrough. As for Eugene, he's miserable, haunted by the knowledge of how different life could be. Sometimes he tells people he's an actor, which was not exactly a lie. He's become a name, a character rather than a person. "You haven't been a Eugene in a year and a half," Charity insists, when he begs her not to call him Knocker. "You're a knocker now. It's what makes you special." He nurses a vague hope of escaping back to Bacon County, but this, he knows, is so much bullshit. Instead, he lives out his fantasies in the letters he sends home, lavish fictions about a successful boxing career. Eugene is not quite a boxer, and so The Knockout Artist is not quite a boxing novel. It partakes of the pleasures of the genre, from the meaty blood sport chatter to the familiar narrative of a comeback that's destined to fail. Still, there is something conspicuously postmodern about Cruise material. Eugene performs to the Rocky soundtrack and scorns Raging Bull for not being true to life. Eugene, like Cruise, knows he is wearing a mask, but even if you aren't really a boxer, can it be enough to look and act like one? If you write your lies insistently enough, will they start to be true? For about 100 pages, these questions simmer beneath the surface. Then, in an extraordinary moment, they come crashing to the fore. Eugene has never had much interest in Charity's research until one day, wondering if she might know something about himself he did not, he breaks into her filing cabinet and finds a stack of pages inside. Case history of Eugene Talmadge Biggs, a.k.a. Knockout, Knocker, K.O. The pages contain Charity's analysis of Eugene, but they also provide, in windy, swaggering, humorless prose, an extended meta-mockery of whatever interpretations a critic might have been scribbling in the margins as they read. Every time he knocks himself out, he dies a little death, descending much lower than the son of Hypnos, Morpheus, the god of dreams. But he is resurrected. He resurrects himself. Here, in the 20th century, is a living example of man's recurrent, archetypal pattern for working out the role of the hero and at the same time denying the inevitability and finality of death. Biggs' audience has the same emotional bath, a bath that lays claim to immortality that Christians have on Easter morning. Hallelujah! He is risen! Even now he has healed himself of death. All praise! Has there been any religion reaching back to the beginning of recorded history that has not had the same primary goal and objective, how to bear the end of life? No. 1,000 times no. Any wonder that Henry James called death the worm at the core of man's existence? None. This goes on and on. It's a good joke, even if it protests too much. But it is also a moment of utter disorientation for the reader as much as for Eugene. He emerges with a nauseating realization. This folder was himself. He held himself in his hands. From here on, the novel reconfigures itself as a confrontation between two lives, or two conceptions of a life, one that is experienced and one that is narrated. Charity might be a bad writer, but she has also gotten down a more truthful account of Eugene's life than he could ever have mustered himself. Her conclusion is that Eugene is stuck in New Orleans in perpetual self-defeat because he never got over his abandonment by his surrogate father, Bud. What Eugene has experienced as obscure, listless suffering becomes a case, a diagnosis. There he is, as if held by Charity's little calipers, pinned in place. But if Charity's case history imposes some order and fixity on Eugene's life, the rest of The Knockout Artist reads like an attempt to thwart this, to replace the tidiness of explanation with something more formless and free. Stylistically, the book becomes a motley, contaminated thing, a mix of Crew's many modes, chatty, terse, demotic, detached, priapic, noirish, gnomic. Various tawdry plots are picked up and discarded as the story staggers onward. The result is thrilling. More than anything else he wrote, The Knockout Artist is unpredictable, unkempt, utterly hostile to interpretation, summary, or genre. It achieves, in form and in style, a sense of blazing, anarchic, profligate freedom. Delusion is the stuff of tragedy, and what ravaged beauty Crew's books possess comes from their deluded sense of hope. It's there, always, just beyond reach, a world without hurt. After The Knockout Artist, Crew seems to have retreated once more into resentment, addiction, the lonely bluster of persona. He wrote a few more novels, but nothing good. The end of his life was marked by the same sort of brutality that plagued its beginnings. He was no longer able to hide his flaws. One day, in 2008, alone in his house in Gainesville, he stabbed himself in the stomach with a hunting knife and yanked the blade up toward his heart. He was found in a pool of blood some hours later and taken to the hospital, where he told doctors that he'd been attacked by an old rival. He lived 4 more years. Charlie Lee is an associate editor of Harper's Magazine. Now I'll be reading another essay. This one is titled Demanding Pleasures on the Art of Observation by Lydia Davis. A person once said to me, "You're a writer. You must have a lot to say." He was making an assumption. I've thought about his assumption many times. Is it that simple? Do I write because I have a lot to say? I do have a lot to say. No matter how much I have said, isn't there always more to say? But then, I imagine everyone has a lot to say, writers and non-writers alike. I can't imagine anyone not having a lot to say, even if they keep their mouth closed. Human beings with a lot to say like to make noise. So do crickets, dogs, mice, other insects, rabbits when frightened or being killed, moose, and many, many others. It is impressive to think of all the creatures on earth and all the different noises they make for different reasons. Some of their noises are effective. Some fail to have an effect. When John Ashbery was invited to deliver the 6 Charles Eliot Norton lectures at Harvard, some 10 years before the turn of the millennium, he surmised that he was being asked to explain his own poetry, which he knew was reputed to be hermetic. But as he explained in his first Norton lecture, he felt that his poetry was the explanation. "The explanation of what?" he asked. "Of my thought, whatever that is." He chose not to try to explain his own poetry and quoted John Barth, who said, "You shouldn't pay very much attention to anything writers say. They don't know why they do what they do." In fact, that could be my epigraph for this essay. And instead, he devoted the 6 lectures to 6 certifiably minor poets who, though far from the only poets who had influenced him, were among the ones he habitually turned to get started, a poetic jumpstart, when his batteries had run down. I had a stimulating and peaceful long afternoon riding a bus west from Boston to Pittsfield, Massachusetts, with only a few stops along the way and only a few other quiet passengers reading the book that eventually resulted from Ashbery's lectures, Other Traditions. It was thoughtful and clearly reasoned and judiciously illustrated with quoted lines from the poets, just enough from each poet, and Ashbery's analysis of one poet after another was enlightening. It was the perfect book to read on a bus, a quiet one. Because the book demanded attention, it was suited to efforts of close, concentrated, but intermittent attention, and at the same time, if I paused in my reading and thinking, the steady, forward motion of the bus included me in something that continued to happen even when I stopped reading. I would read a portion of a page and then look up to think about it, gazing out at a landscape that was fairly monotonous, just monotonous enough not to distract me. The woods and more woods, and occasional fields, and occasional houses and barns, and one broad river, and one steep climb to a mountaintop, and one descent therefrom, and all along the way at some point the topiary sign spelling out Friendlies. This was the Massachusetts Turnpike, which was already familiar to me from previous trips. What a sensible idea of Ashbery's, I thought, and modest, to direct attention away from himself. It also worked to his own benefit. He was more interested in exploring these other poets and articulating his explanation than he was in repeating his ideas about himself, if he would admit to any. It can also be dangerous to look too closely into the magic that produces something you write. Barth, writers don't know why they do what they do. After I have been asked why I write, and as I am attempting to answer that question, the word bother becomes relevant in a particular sense, though I was not conscious of it in just that sense 1 year ago, before I read what I read recently. The word bother came into my life in a specific positive sense when I read an interview given by John Ashbery in which he talked about how he encountered the source of his long poem, Self-Portrait in a Convex Mirror, and its title. It's not that John Ashbery is always my highest or most useful example for things. It is more a matter of chance in this case. This essay that I'm writing, or attempting to write, in answer to the question of why I write, gets written in real time, and things happen during that time. During that time, the book group I am part of chose to read Ashbery's collection of poems, Self-Portrait in a Convex Mirror. All of us had read it before, but when you reach your 60s and 70s, as we have, a book you can truthfully say you have read may actually have been read by you so long ago that it is as though not read. For this meeting, we planned to read the title poem together with whichever other poems interested each of us. In intervals between continuing to read the title poem, which I found dense and hard to understand, I was thinking about a title I associate with Ashbery, Peter and Mother, which I often think of, even though it may not be the title of any poem of his, because I wasn't sure it was the title of a poem of his rather than, say, the title of an article about him. I searched the internet for it and instead found a 2015 interview with him by Adam Fitzgerald in the magazine Interview. What I found in reading the interview were some comments he made about titling his poems, but also, along the way, two or even three possible answers to why he wrote. About the titles of his poems, he simply said, "They just come to me." The first thing he said was that he first encountered the painting by the young Parmigianine titled Self-Portrait in a Convex Mirror in the form of a reproduction in a Times Book Review, and that he was immediately grabbed and bothered by the painting and thought he would like to do something with it. But he did nothing at the time. Many years later, he happened to see the painting itself in a museum in Vienna. He said, "And that did it. I knew I had to do something about it then." And he used the word bother in this way, in this interview or another, about at least one other thing that inspired a poem. The formulation, "do something about it," is a blunt and truthful way of expressing your response to material that bothers you in a good way when you encounter it. You are listening to the essay Demanding Pleasures on the Art of Observation by Lydia Davis from Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I encountered the Ashbery interview when I was beginning to struggle to answer the question of why I write. Here is a very concise and truthful answer. The reason I write a particular story may be because something, which I call material, as in raw material, bothers me until I do something about it. In these cases, bother is wholly positive. The beauty of black cows across the road, the geometry of the positions they adopted, bothered me in that way, and the shadow of a grain of salt on a counter bothered me one late afternoon. I think of the phrase Peter and Mother more often than anyone might imagine because I like the way it sounds, and yet it is awkward. Some of the pieces of language that persist in my memory are ones that seem stylistically awkward or faulty. One is Ashbery's, or not Ashbery's, title, Peter and Mother. Another is Shakespeare's, When Yellow Leaves, or None, or Few, Do Hang Upon Those Boughs, which I can hear also as the first notes of the musical scale sung out of order, Mi, or Do, or Re. Yet another, which I hear is redundant, I remember from Moby Dick, but is in fact quoted by Melville from the Book of Job, and I only am escaped alone to tell thee. The escape is only temporary. In the first British edition of the novel, the epilogue in which Ishmael speaks the sentence was mistakenly omitted, and so it appeared to readers that Ishmael had drowned along with the others, and if so, how could he be telling this story? Three of the five in my talkative original family are gone, their voices and thoughts permanently silenced now, except on paper in various places in this house, and the other one besides me, left alive, is declining, as I am inevitably too, though at a different rate and from different causes. Either he or I will be the only one left, eventually, who can bear witness to the life of that particular family, temporarily, escaped alone to tell thee. Another wrong order that is perfectly good in the sentence where it sits is Flaubert's, she closed the door behind him when he left, with a feeling of satisfaction that surprised even her. Speaking of Emma Bovary and her father, whose company during his visit had irritated her. I, when I was a teacher of writing, though I was not overly didactic or rule-bound, used to advise young writers to tell the actions in the order in which they happened. But in this case, Flaubert is achieving a sly emphasis, whether he meant to or not. Emma closes the door on her father even before he is out the door. The second helpful thing Ashbery said is in answer to Fitzgerald's question about how he reacts to his own work when he rereads it. I frequently like it very much when I do read it. When I come across it, maybe it's in a desk drawer or somewhere, and it's some poem that you wrote and have completely forgotten about. When you read it, you're thinking it was written by someone else. It's this sort of feeling of ecstasy that can be supplied by nothing else. Maybe that's why one writes. This divorce from oneself, this feeling of distance or estrangement from one's own writing, is in concrete and permanent form described in an account that I was told, or that I read, about George Aubin as he was suffering from the early stages of dementia. He was walking around a room in his house reading his own poems, which had been framed and hung on the wall. I may have this somewhat inaccurate, but the gist I believe is correct. Walking from one to another, reading them in a room at home, and observing to whoever was there, witnessing this, that he found them to be quite good, not knowing the poems were his own. Although he did not know they were his, he clearly felt a compatibility with them. They were poems he liked and would have been glad to have written. The process of writing, or this kind of process of writing anyway, that I'm considering here, includes something outside oneself. It is something outside myself that comes to take hold of me and in a sense use me as an instrument to come into being. I am instrumental. I am not making something up myself, out of myself. Something outside me is being given or offered to me by chance. I then concentrate on it, give it shape, and in the process open myself to developments in the material that seem to come of their own volition. This openness to involuntary developments is what is most endangered by a knock on my study door at the wrong time, though strangely less endangered by the ongoing hubbub that may surround me on a crowded train or in a bar or cafe, because no one knows me there, and even a momentary intrusion is likely to be impersonal and undisturbing. Can you please move your coat? Ashbery experienced, he said, ecstasy at reading a poem of his own that he liked. When I began trying in all honesty to answer the question of why I write, one of the first answers I came to was for the pleasure of it. There is, for me at least, pleasure at each stage of the writing. There is the initial impulse, the recognition of the potential richness of the material, got to do something about that, and then the forming of that original provocative material into something that, it seems to me at the moment, couldn't have any other or better form, working at the form until it seems to fit perfectly what the material asks for. And then, later, the tension passed, eventually, no hurry, the sharing of the finished piece, seeing it printed, or still later, going back and reading it again, usually for some practical reason, or else just because I opened to that page, or reading it aloud and enjoying someone else's enjoyment. We relish together what that original material turned into. But it may be more accurate to say that at the beginning of the process is emotion, though often that emotion is pleasure. Something that was not a reason I started writing in the first place was for fame or money. But I may have thought, as a 20-year-old, that one wrote to convey a message, as in a serious poem. But I soon stopped thinking I needed to convey a message, or even have a message. I had some messages inside me then, and I still have plenty of messages inside me, but not to convey explicitly, or even implicitly, in writing, except involuntarily, maybe only in rants or harangues out loud to people, people who would rather I quiet it down. I don't write to convey a message, and I don't write stories to achieve any particular purpose. I don't write stories to persuade a reader of something I believe, though I have many, many beliefs. I don't write a story for any particular audience. I don't think of a reader as I am writing it, though after I have finished writing it, I am glad or touched if a person enjoys it or is moved by it. I don't write a story to move someone, though someone may be moved. It is not that direct. It is more indirect. I encounter something that moves me. I let a story evolve from it, or I guide the material into the form of a story that fits it, that suits the power or beauty of that original material. Then a reader reads the story, and if that reader is of a certain temperament, not too unlike mine in one or several respects, for instance, having a similar sense of humor, or any sense of humor at all, he or she may be moved by the story, but moved, I could say, only in a sense by my story as intermediary, as conveying what was inherent for me as I saw it, or possible, in the original material. When I think about that 20-year-old searching for a serious topic, where was it for her to be serious poem? I believe she actually admired good poems she had read and wanted to write a poem as good. Later, when I was no longer trying to write good poems, but trying to write good stories, I probably wanted to write prose as eccentric and distinct and clear and insistent as Samuel Beckett's. I would copy out sentences from Beckett and study them. John Clare said in a poem that he found his poems in the fields and only wrote them down. This is not exactly what happens for me, and it probably did not for him. but my experience is that a piece of writing starts with something outside coming in. I write something because it occurs to me to write it. It occurs to me, rather than I go out in search of it. Going out in search of a suitable topic is something I did early on when I thought, as a 20-year-old wanting to write poetry, that a poem should be serious and have a serious subject, so I should search my mind and experience for a serious subject and then write about it. I think it is all right in the beginning to want to write poetry and to think a poem should be serious. It is a starting point. Later, things will reverse direction and it will be the poem, or at least the raw material for the poem, that comes to you wanting to be written. I don't really see a poem as an animated creature asking to come to me, but Russell Edson, whose stories I found crucially liberating when I first encountered them in my 20s, and whose imagination was wild and domestic and uninhibited, and open to considering the cruelty of family relations, and open to impossible situations, and open to inanimate things being demanding, and who tended to anthropomorphize things, including structural parts of a house, turned a poem into an animated creature in one of his stories, New Prose About an Old Poem. I say he wrote stories, but he said he wrote poems. This little story is about a poem that is too good to throw away, but not good enough to publish. The poem is carried away by the wind, and the poet is relieved because he won't have to continue reconsidering it every now and then. But then the wind returns it to his desk. The poem is glad to be home and wants to be read again. The poet thinks he might send it out in the mail, submit it for publication, but he knows he won't and says he will have to go on being nice to it for the rest of his life. He is dramatizing the situation of a writer's having a folder or drawer full of drafts that are not hopeless, but not finished or really good either. A locked or paralyzed situation. Most writers have these folders or drawers. I'm not sure I want to know why I write, but I don't mind talking about how I have written certain of my stories. How I Wrote Certain of My Books is a title that has always lingered in my mind, not because I have read the book and know it well, but because of the word certain, which sounds a little uncomfortable to me in English, at least as it appears in a title, though it's more natural there in the original French. The book could be considered a counterpart to George Steiner's about how he did not write certain of his books. It is the title of a collection of works by and about Raymond Roussel, and also of the book's lead essay. I have looked it up just now, and only now do I see that via Roussel, John Ashbery enters this essay again, because Roussel's book includes two essays by Ashbery. I don't have the book here in the house, but Roussel, I now see when I look at other traditions again, is one of the six writers Ashbery talks about in his Merton lectures. In exploring how I have written certain of my stories, I have advanced as far as understanding that a story begins with something outside coming in and involving emotion, often pleasure. I write something because it occurs to me to write it. It is in some sense found in a field, and the first pleasure is this encounter with something coming in or wanting to come in, something that demands, in an impersonal way, to be formed into something else. It may be an idea of my own that seems to come to me from myself, or it may be material that is actually outside of me, a companionable bug, or a slow-moving cow, or the strangeness of the word organized when used for a tropical storm, or an empathetic old woman saying something unexpected that I overhear on a train as she stands over me in the aisle. This material presents itself and makes me want to see it be expressed in a form, a formal form, that is just right. I then go forward writing it without thinking too much, guided by a part of my mind not quite under my control. I do not stop to look ahead toward the end of the story. I do not think about what it means unless I look at it much later from the outside and then wonder, though I usually do not, what it means. Part of the pleasure, then, is handling the language, moving the words around. I place the punctuation so that it does just what I want it to do to my meaning. I see the story evolve. I change this and that to make the parts of a story or a sentence better. I hear silently in my head the way it sounds. Then I see what the story looks like when it's done. I see a story exist that did not exist before. It has come into being from the collaboration between the more conscious, controlling action of my mind and the more intuitive, impulsive, and associative action of my mind. But the pleasure of writing is a demanding one because of its unrelenting demands. For just the right syntax, the right balance, the right sounds, the right words, the right spellings of our often strange English words. But then the strictness of the demands is part of the pleasure. Other emotions may come in along with the pleasure of encountering the material. I often relish human behavior, though I am also often horrified by it. But I can relish the language and the handling of language, even when writing about behavior that horrifies me. I almost always revel in the behavior of animals and insects and even minerals and the phenomena of physics. I am bemused and a little in awe when I see how long a shadow is cast by the near horizontal afternoon sunlight from a single grain of salt on the kitchen counter. In another story, which takes place on the same kitchen counter, I am sympathetic to a little bug that runs away from my sponge and feel affection as I imagine, or don't imagine, but know that the bug has business elsewhere. He may simply have forgotten it for a moment until my sponge shoved him suddenly, inadvertently, and off he went. The first pleasure comes from amusement at the sight of the hurrying bug, but a further pleasure comes from choosing to write the word business in relation to the bug. But because I have respect for bugs and their well-organized lives, I hope the story does not seem condescending. In another story, I feel less alone when I am visited by a bug that stays up late to walk down the page of my book when I am also up late reading. Nabokov, too, respected the anatomy and behavior of insects enough and language enough to object to Eleanor Marx Aveling's translation of a particular moment early in Madame Bovary, in which she describes flies as crawling. "No," he says, full of Nabokovian indignation, "flies don't crawl, they walk." I never tire of enjoying his concern for accuracy here and elsewhere. But though I know what it means, can I actually define crawl? A translator's habit is to look up a word even when she thinks she knows it perfectly well. He is right, of course, flies do not crawl. Only the little feet of the flies would have touched the inner surface of those glasses with their attractive dregs of cider. I wrote quite a long story that started with a question about how companionable a few ants might be for me in the kitchen as they hauled away with difficulty some small crumbs of Parmesan cheese to wherever their hidden home was, down a tiny hole in the tiled counter. The story went on almost of its own accord, one part naturally inviting the next, to remember friends of mine since deceased who, being lonely, I suppose, once fell into the habit, where they used to live in Germany during World War II, of putting out food for a housefly who would join them at mealtimes and then mourn the fly when it died on Christmas Day. Other things in our world may anger and frustrate me or make me despair. Those emotions rarely come out directly in a story. They simply continue to abide inside me, having matured deep into my bones over time. They may come out indirectly in a story, or not at all, but if I read it later, I can see that they lie somewhere beneath or behind the story, or in its very fabric. How could they not, since they are part of what I am, and the story is coming from me? I wrote a story called The Cows. I did not write it with any intention. I did not even write it all at once. It took 3 years to accumulate. The way it originated was as simple as looking out the window or standing by the road looking across the road and observing the cows, who over the years started by being three heifers, then grew up, two of them bearing one calf each. After the two calves were adults, they were taken away. I occasionally wrote down what I saw. After 3 years, I had more than 80 observations. I made a little book of it with accompanying photos. Only later did I realize that the emotions involved in the story were not only my various forms of pleasure and sometimes amusement or sympathy as I watched the positions and behaviors of the cows and their calves, as well as the demanding pleasure of setting down my observations of them, but also my pain and sorrow over the treatment of most cows in the world. I could see what these particular cows, my neighbor cows, preferred when given the almost complete freedom they had to go in and out of the open door of their barn, to drink from a bathtub by the fence, to walk to a particular spot in their large field, in winter to stand in the snow, broadside to the warm sun. Even when they were larger than their mothers, the calves went on nursing now and then, coming over for a few tugs at the teat, and their mother stood still and waited for them to be done. All I wanted to do for my own satisfaction in writing down my observations was to portray exactly the way these cows looked and what they did, black on green or white or tan in the field. But maybe I was also relishing their freedom to make their choices. My story, The Cows, is almost purely descriptions of an undramatic reality, loving descriptions. Though my objective portrayals may not appear overtly loving, there is love in the motivation behind them, and sometimes another emotion shows through, quite a strong feeling on my part, not suppressed, determining the choice of what I describe. My emotion was for the plight of cows and animals in general, subjected to human manipulation or intrusion or territorial takeover. But did I also love these particular cows? Probably, even though one of them charged me when I got too close to her calf, though there was a fence between us. She did not recognize with any gratitude that I was the one who, on a particularly hot day, had filled their dry bathtub with buckets of water carried across the road from my own well after they had been lowing for an hour or more while the three of us stay-at-home older neighborhood women, one up the hill, one a couple hundred yards down the road, and myself in the house opposite, were growing increasingly concerned about them. The lowing of the cows was purely their expression of discomfort, but did it then become communication to us? Does voiced expression involuntarily become communication when someone responds? Or in this case, was it already meant as communication? I don't believe I put down on paper precise descriptions of the cows in order to transport anyone to the place where I stood as I was looking at them. What I was after was more abstract, almost clinical, despite my loving motivation, an exact match between what I saw, what pleased and interested me at that moment, and the words that would describe it so exactly that there could be no other way to describe it. I had no overall plan for these observations, which were entered in a notebook among other material. There was simply the impulse each time to write just that one description. Then weeks would go by, or maybe just a day or two, or months, before I was moved to write another description or observation. This matters to the outcome because if I had conceived the plan for 83 observations of the cows in the beginning, I might have been tempted to force the observations to come to me. I mean, I would have gone searching for them. And so the set of 83 observations was written by accumulation over several years. I simply looked out the window with a natural, recurring, reflexive interest at the field where the cows like to stand and occasionally walk, very rarely run, and when something I saw struck me, I made a note of it. Was it communication before it was published? I have time to read one more piece, which is from the August 2025 issue of Harper's. The title is Passenger Pigeon. From a Delta Airlines passenger's account of a flight on March 24th, as reported by NBC News. When I boarded at Minneapolis-St. Paul tonight, I overheard another passenger tell a flight attendant there was a pigeon on the plane. The pilot got on the mic and confirmed that a pigeon was on the plane and said he had no experience with this situation. Baggage handlers boarded and carried the pigeon off. People applauded. A young girl asked if she could pet it. The plane eventually pulled away and began taxiing to the runway, and then another pigeon emerged. It was caught, and we returned to the gate. The pilot said when he radioed the control tower about our coming back due to a pigeon, the air traffic controller said that was a first for him. The pilot told him it was the second time for him, the first being half an hour earlier. Thanks so much for joining me today for this episode of Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Ellen Ward, saying goodbye for now and hoping that you'll join me again next time.